This is an important topic, and it's a timely topic. For those of you who are joining the call, learn how to get the PPP loan, you're on the wrong call. We're talking about how to deal with the one that you already have. The timing, it's certainly a little late for the folks to go into to the discussion of whether to get one, although it may still be open. I don't know, but we're not on that issue. We're also not on the issue of whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. What we did, realizing the importance of this topic, and quite frankly, many of you just expressing comments and concerns and doubt and discussions with us, we thought that it had a far broader audience, and judging by how many people have joined the call, that appears to be the case. When this comes up, we need to get you guys information. I quickly decided that the best thing to do was to get the people who know the most about accounting and these kind of issues. Russ Farmer, who's a SBTC board member and has been our liaison with DCAA for many years, is on, and he will bring us up to date on what we've been doing with the DCAA in general, and then his recent discussions with DCAA on this particular issue. We have Brian on the phone with us from Jameson and Company, and I picked Brian and David Daniel Kim from the Chevron and Rockford CPA firm to be on this. We've been on panels in the past at national SBIR conferences, and it made sense to, knowing their knowledge and expertise, that I would ask them to talk about this. We're going to go to each of the three panelists for a brief introduction, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like that. Then we're going to wrap it up. Because of the volume of people and the interest, please keep your questions short and focused. We always understand the desire of some people to tell us about the policies and history and background and all these other wonderful things. Today is not the time to share that. We really want to get to as many questions as we can. So that's going to be the format. As Alex mentioned earlier, please put your microphone until you're ready to talk, and let's get the conversation started with Russ, and let Russ give us a little bit of our history with DCAA, and we've worked closely with them and actually accomplished a good bit over the years. But Russ, and then let Russ share his comments on PPP.
Great. This is Russ Farmer with Executive Vice President, ADA Technologies. As Jerry indicated, I had the opportunity to chair the SBTC NDIA committee meeting with DCAA a few years back, where we were having extreme difficulty getting our consulting costs properly audited and recovered, and as a result of our committee, we were able to meet on a number of occasions with DCAA and address that specific issue, but we also brought up a number of other issues to the point where really the key aspects of issues with small businesses and DCA were pretty well eliminated, and we've maintained communication periodically with different members at the DCA headquarters on various issues. I had the opportunity to reach out to one of the senior people there at DCA headquarters to find out exactly what they were doing as far as this PPE program was concerned, if they had any guidance, because there was a lot of miscommunication. I have received some feedback from them, the summary of all of that, which is basically that DCAA does not want to have the government pay for the same expenses twice, and so they are wanting to see and make sure that if you do receive PPE loans, which are subsequently forgiven, that that excludes any kind of claim for expenses to the government. And so they're going to be looking at that fairly closely to see that if you do receive funds from the PPE that are forgiven, that what those funds are covered for expenses that you will not be able to claim. The one thing that I would point out, and I think this is going to be kind of my comments on the PPE program, is I've gone through this at ADA Technology in some depth, that one of the requirements on anyone who owns 20% or more of the company, they must certify that the funds will be used to retain workers. I'm reading this off of the application purposely. The funds will be used to retain workers and maintain payroll or make mortgage interest payments. And there's some requirements that 75% of this must be used to retain workers. Now, what that tells me is that if you do not receive the funds, you would have to terminate these employees because you don't have work for them. And if you do have work for them, then the money would not be used to retain those workers because the projects that they would be working on would produce the funding for that that employee. So I, it's if you're have a good, strong backlog, then you're not going to be needing the retention of these workers because you've got adequate work for them. So that's a point that I think will drive what I will be saying during the course of this hour, which is that the only employees that you would require these loans to retain would be employees you don't have work for, in which case they would be charging strictly indirect costs. And those indirect costs then would be the basis for to be reducing those indirect costs in any kind of billing rate proposal or incurred costs submittal. So that's kind of, that's where I'm going to be coming from, and I'd be glad to answer other questions after Brian and Daniel have an opportunity to introduce themselves and give you a little bit of background. Back to you, Jerry.
Yeah, thanks, Russ. One of the things that we did do with DCAA is there have been several memos out basically making small business and SBA companies kind of low audit priorities. And we've had some direction out of DOD as well as the situation. And we were getting tremendous numbers of complaints a few years back about the paperwork burden, about the DCAA, really horrible audits and nitpicking and really driving people crazy. And so we were pleased that, that those things have been, by and large, correct, made better. Let's just say that I won't say better. Let me turn to Brian. And Brian is the point person with Jameson & Company, and Jameson & Company, of course, has been at all our national conventions and is a recognized name in accounting. We have some new people on the line. Understand just one general principle as we talk to our next two panelists. This is accounting. If you don't understand, if you don't have experience in accounting for the government, please take some courses, go online, learn some things, because there are enough differences that you can get in trouble under any circumstances if you aren't careful. And so there are people who can help.
There are some online courses, and obviously there are some, not anymore. I guess they're not conferences and meetings where they have briefings and discussions. But this is a tricky area under the best of circumstances, and this is a pretty heavily this issue is even much more interesting because of the changing character of these loans. Let me go to Brian next, and then we'll go to Dan.
Hello, everyone. My name is Brian LaCroix. I'm a partner at Jamison & Company. Our firm specializes in government grant and contract accounting. Seems for like the past month and a half or so, all I've been dealing with is PPP loans. We spent quite a bit of time helping a large percentage of our client base apply for the loans. And now we're starting to transition, of course, into the forgiveness piece of those loans. And what I'd like to just say about it is it is definitely a moving target. Everyone seems to be clamoring for guidance on the program and how the forgiveness piece is going to work. And because of the speed that the law made its way through Congress and the Senate, of course, there are a lot of open items that they are trying to nail down along the way. So what I'll be happy to do today is share our perspective on where we think the final guidance is going to come in. In addition to that, I mean, we will, of course, be happy to comment on the types of expenses and stuff that we believe will be forgiven once the final applications come out. And also, in addition to that, of course, we're dealing with the credits that will have to go back on the government contracts and grants as a result of costs claimed on the PPP loans. So we're definitely trying to hit a moving target at this point, but we're happy to help out any way we can. Thanks, Jerry.
Can everyone please check again that their phone is on mute? We've got several people on the line that have not muted their lines.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. And we'll go to Dan. And Dan has been on panels with me and shared his knowledge and experience at SBIR conferences. Of course, we're not going to have SBIR conferences for a while, but we certainly thank him for sharing his thoughts with us.
Hello, everyone. This is Dan Kim. Got a lot of echoing going on there. Okay, thank you. So this is Dan Kim. I'm with Chevron and Rockers. I'm the managing partner of the CP firm. My background is I've worked at DCAA for about 10 years in different positions, like the supervisor auditor for the National Capital Region. I've worked at, Maryland offices, Virginia offices, and such. Also, there's a subject matter expert position at DCAA. It's known as a technical specialist. So I've served as accounting system technical specialist, also anchor cost technical specialist, and basically had to travel in that position to different DCAA offices and help the audit teams that are doing complicated assignments. So that's how I was fortunate enough to gather the experience and the training. And then about 5 years ago from now, I left the agency and started my own CPA firm and provide accounting services and consultation to government contractors. So that's my background. We've been quite the busy with assisting different contractors apply for PPP and other kinds of support. We've also been, being a small CP firm, we've also been very busy helping other unfortunate folks with, unemployment insurance and such too. Now we're entering a phase, like Brian said, into assisting government contractors with their record keeping and use of the PPP funds to make sure that the most possible amount of forgiveness can be achieved. So it's a great honor to be here, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Okay, back to you, Jer.
Thanks, guys. I have to keep remembering to take off my muting. I'm muting my phone, and hopefully everybody else. There's a whole variety of areas of concerns, and we at SBTC usually, when something really is hot, we start getting emails from you guys, and we've certainly got a number from on this particular issue. Let me go to the co-chair, Bob Smith, and Bob had sent in several questions. And Bob, if you'd pick one of your questions that you want to throw out for the discussion, and I'm going to ask everybody to keep their questions to under a minute. So formulate your questions and try to keep it focused very clearly on the issues. Bob, you have one of your...
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Jerry. My question is on cash versus accrual. So we get these loans, and let's say we got the loan, say, the 15th or 20th of April, and we had a month's worth of federal accounting that we've done. And one of the things that many companies can do is move their employees off federal government contracts and put them onto some of their commercial work. And so I pay my payroll on, say, the 5th of May, and now I've, you know, taken that whole month, and my question is, what do I have to give back for the April, because it really only starts on the date, on, say, April 20th, that I got the loan. So I'm not quite sure how that works, of what's due back to the government as a cash versus accrual. So I'd like to hear from anybody that has an opinion on that.
So as far as the cash versus accrual issue with the PPP forgiveness, the verbiage in the law said expenses that are incurred and paid. So right now, that particular verbiage is being debated to determine what it actually means, meaning do all the expenses have to be incurred within the eight-week period and also paid within that eight-week period. Now, the majority of the opinions out there believe that once the final guidance comes out, that it's going to fall back to incurred, which means the accrual basis of accounting. So the people realize that expenses are incurred and accrued during a period, but then they're paid subsequently, and there's a little bit of a lag time between the incurred piece and the paid piece. So the people believe that the final guidance is going to simply say that the expenses have to be incurred and then paid within the reasonable period after they've been incurred. So the thought is that people won't have to all of a sudden switch payroll pay dates just in order to get the payroll into that forgiveness period. But the final guidance is expected in the next week on that. And I know that's one item that they're hoping is going to be finalized in that final guidance.
Okay, and this is Dan, if I may add on to that, Brian. So I am in agreement with what Brian is saying, and if we apply the audit techniques that the government uses at DCAA, one requirement is that these financial statements and records are supposed to be presented in accordance to GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles, and then GAAP does say that these records are supposed to be kept on an accrual basis. So any incurred cost, whether it's PPP or not, when it's subject to audit by the government, it's based on accrual when it was incurred, like Brian's saying. And then a secondary check that the auditors can do is to ask for proof of payment. Now, the proof of payment date doesn't necessarily have to be, right, the same date that it was incurred, because that's not practical. But the amount, so when it relates to PPP, my speculation is that the forgiveness amount will depend on the accrual of these payroll expenses for that 8-week period, and then they can further take a step to make sure that it has actually been paid and request proof of payment, which for payroll is very easy to provide, right? Another reason this seems to be important is because I'm getting, and it's quite interesting, I'm getting a lot of calls from business owners asking, okay, can I make a payment within this 8-week period for employees in a pay period that was way in the past? Because I want to maximize my forgiveness amount, right? So can I claim that these employees worked 3 months ago, and then make the payment for within this 8-week period, and then get that amount forgiven? Now, logically thinking, that shouldn't be the case, right? The government shouldn't allow that. Neither taxpayers would be happy with that. So given that, it also makes sense that, you know, the period of performance, when the employee worked, that would be the guideline into determining the forgivable amount.
This is Bob Schmidt again. It's not so much the forgivable amount I'm concerned about. It's what I have to give back to the government. So it's those employees that were paid for the entire month on May 5th, mm-hmm. but only worked on government contracts between April 1st and April 20th. So I've got mm-hmm. 10 days that they're working on non-government contracts. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, none of that that was in the payroll was in fact, part of PPP, because mm-hmm. they weren't working from the 20th of April to the 30th of April on government contracts. So therefore, none of that should be able to be reclaimed by the government.
Okay.
That's
so
the
just
question.
Yes, and just to clarify your question, let me talk a little bit about the mechanics of that. So your question is asking, in the case that a certain amount of the forgiven amount needs to be credited back to the government, how do I determine how much should be credited back to the government? Am I rephrasing your question correctly?
That's fine, yes. Thank you.
Okay. Does anybody else on the panel want to address this, or should I just go ahead?
Go on ahead, and I'll jump in afterwards, Daniel.
All right, thank you. So I think this goes into another topic that I think may come up, but it's to determine whether or not this PPP forgiven amount, because that's what's subject to credit, is a direct cost or an indirect cost, right? So the person who asked the question is kind of packaging the forgiven amount as a direct cost. My personal opinion, this is my personal opinion, and panelists, please do disagree with me if you do, is that the PPP credit should be more considered like an indirect credit, right? Just kind of like fringe benefits. So those folks who go on leave, the leave amount is considered an indirect expense, so it's collected together into the fringe pool and then allocated to every contract, right, according to how much labor is expensed. I think the forgiveness amount should be done in the same way too, put into one pool, and then that pool should be calculated into a rate by dividing by all labor and then allocated to every contract in proportion to the labor that is expensed on each contract. And then that allocated amount should be the credit to the government. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah, this Russ Farmer. First and foremost, I am not an attorney. Bob, I understand that you are. However, I get back to the basic premise and the application, which is the funds will be used to retain workers. So any worker who is working direct or who's working on a commercial project, I find it difficult how an individual would be able to sign this under penalties of liability and charges of fraud, that you're requesting funds from the government to pay for somebody who is actively working. So the only reason that you would logically apply for this loan would be to cover individuals that you don't have work for, which means they would be charging indirect. So that gets back to the point that Daniel made, which is They would be charging indirect because you don't have work for them and would have to lay them off otherwise. So they would be charging indirect, and all of the allocation of the forgiveness or the amounts would then be charged to the indirect pool accordingly.
Hey, Russ?
Yes.
David Modell, Triton. So I think you're making a leap that I don't think is the paperwork when we signed the loan. I get the forgiveness part, but the applying for loan part, all they asked you, well, what was really asked, if I can paraphrase, is will you be affected by COVID-19, or are you affected by COVID-19, which every business in the world has been affected by COVID-19. They put a low bar. They didn't ask the question you're framing. Now, I get it, that the paying twice part I get, and the whole forgiveness thing is different, but you seem to be saying you shouldn't even have applied for the loan unless you were certain you were going to face a layoff, and I don't agree with that. I think that's a leap you're making. I don't see that in the questions they ask in the application.
I have the application right here in front of me, and I'll read it word for word. It says the funds will be used to retain workers and maintain payroll. Okay, that's not a leap of faith. That is
no, but that's what the funds are used for. But well,
to retain workers?
Well, it could be, but it doesn't mean that you would otherwise. You're making a leap of saying, if not for the money, they would be laid off. I'm not sure I read that in what you're reading.
Okay. You're entitled to your interpretation. I faced this and asked my management, okay, give me a list of the people that you're going to lay off if we don't get this this loan, and I couldn't get a list of anybody that they were planning to lay off. So, you know, it's to use to retain workers means that you're going to keep them on payroll if you get that loan, is how I read that. I don't know how you can read it otherwise. You say, well, you know, maybe down the road sometime I may have to lay this person off in 6 months. It is used to retain those workers for that 8-week period.
Hey, this is Dan again, and I think this difference in opinion is also a result of the fact that the PPP itself is a moving target, like Brian alluded to. It being a moving target basically means that there's more details coming out as time passes. One example would be like the requirements for capitals, right? So in the initial phase of the PPP application, there was no language stating that if you have adequate funds available elsewhere, you don't qualify. There was no such language, right? So everybody applied to include our favorite hamburger shop, right, Shake Shack. And they clearly do have funds available, but they were able to apply. They were not breaking any rules in applying. The administration later recognized, oh, this is a problem, right? So then they added language saying if you have, you know, adequate funds elsewhere, then you should not apply for this. And then basically stated that those who have received the PPP and have adequate funds should refund it, right? It kind of goes with also the interpretation of what Russ is saying, you know, and the disagreement too. I think a lot of it is changing as we go, and then it changes as we have, a lot of you have already accepted the funds, right? But one thing is a fact is, one fact is that the application process was to look at your monthly average payroll, which is everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And then multiply 2.5 to that, which is, you know, everybody's salary times 2.5. And then they're asking you to spend that within 8 weeks. So you got to borrow 10 weeks worth of your monthly payroll. And then they're asking you to spend all of that within 8 weeks, right? So that, I don't, you know, you can interpret that any way you want, but the fact is we have to, that's the rules. That's how you come up with a forgivable amount, right?
This is Jerry. Let me just throw out the brief legislative history of this. The congressional committees, under the situation where they knew there was going to be a severe economic impact across the board. There are trillions of dollars being given, granted, bought, whatever, invested, you want to call it. The Small Business Committee wanted to get money to small business to help them through this problem. They originally tried to do it as a grant. Just, we're going to give every small business some money. That was how bad the economy was, how bad things were. They were trying to do that. So they came up with this idea. Once there was criticism, then all of a sudden they're now doing, it is a fluid situation, and they're trying to, after the fact, put in rules and regulations. This is just the background to let you know that Congress was doing its best to get small business money. They did things like making the loans no recourse, didn't have any collateral have to be posted, did a lot of good things in an effort to get money. Those things are now evolving and changing, and the government is now, after the fact, doing that. And that's why this discussion is important, because on the face of the documents, the law and the documents, it was a pretty easy thing to do and pretty free and clear. Let's go on to some other questions. If somebody else has another question.
Yeah, Kevin here. I've got a question. And they basically, pardon me, as I grab for it. So for government contract accounting, what in brief? Can you hear me?
Yeah, state your name and firm.
Kevin Burns, Precision Combustion.
Okay.
For government contract accounting, what in brief is how we might process the credit on our books against our contracts? Will it probably be an overhead adjustment? I think that's what Dan might have just suggested. Or something much more complicated? And please elaborate if you know more.
This is Brian from Jamison & Company. We agree with Daniel as well that we believe that it's going to come through as a credit on through the indirect rates. We think that's the practical approach to it, but we're still waiting on any guidance from DCAA as to how they expect to see the credit. So that will be the telltale sign, but we believe it should come through as an indirect credit to the indirect costs.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Russ Farmer. I would agree with that.
Okay, another question.
Yeah, this is Andy Sherman with Powderman, and it's a follow-up to that. The contracts we have are generally cost not to exceed. So I'm looking at the practical management is if we give a credit, meaning we reduce our incurred rates that are applied to this year's billings, that we should, are we actually then reducing the overall amount of the contracts by that, or do we just overspend knowing that our rates versus our forward pricing agreement are going to be lower than our agreed rates, that we incur additional costs and spend that contract up to the limit? Thank you.
That's actually a very excellent and practical question. It kind of puts into perspective what a business manager must do. Yeah, so the credit in and of itself, like you said, of course reduces the indirect rates that you will arrive at. And if you are performing on a cost-by contract, then your billings will be on a provisional billing rate, right, a PBR. After the end of the year, you will submit what's known as an incurred cost submission, which you'll use to determine the actual indirect rates to settle on the contract. And like you said, the impact of this credit will indeed lower the actual rates at the end of the year. Now, knowing that, given that, whether I should spend more than I would have normally done for other indirect expenses to, increase the rates back to what it should be, I think that's a business decision, right? But nonetheless, as you do that, the three major requirements for expenses are, and if you satisfy this, I think you'd be safer, right? One is that it should be allowable, right? So the expenses should be allowable. You shouldn't just go out and purchase things. Second thing is that it has to be allocable, right? So that the expense must have been driven by a need from the contract, right? And it has to be reasonable. That's the third one, right? So the contracting officer may take a look at it and say, hey, this is an unreasonable fringe benefit of a Ferrari, right? And then disallow that. So we do get PPP. We do get forgiveness from it. That's a wonderful thing. And the purpose of this forgiveness is to save the economy, right? And given that, you know, I think you guys are wise to make the right decision.
Hello?
Yes.
Depending on the type of contract as well, you may be able to rebudget and spend more on the direct side to spend out the funds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, this is Russ Farmer. It doesn't change the overall funded value of the contract. However you set cost-plus contract, however you incur those costs, it doesn't change or recognize the credit for the forgiveness of the loan. It doesn't change the funded value of that contract, so you can continue to burn up to that funded value.
Mm-hmm.
This is Dennis Wagner, Wilkins Science.
Go ahead, Dennis.
So it's right. Dan, got cut off.
So we have commercial contracts. We've got firm fixed price contracts. We've got cost contracts, and we've got internal products that our people can charge to. So if we do a credit back. Let's just say our loan's $100,000. I'm hearing that some saying that whole amount gets credited back to the indirect rates, but then that gets allocated across all of those contracts. So it doesn't really it only impacts the cost type contracts, if I'm understanding what you're saying. Is that correct?
Yeah, Dennis, this is Russ Farmer again, and I'll play this back because I think it's important. The comments that we made relating to this credit and applying that credit to your indirect cost pool, the theory behind that and the practicality behind that is that these individuals are being kept on the payroll because you don't have work for them, and they'll be charging indirect. So this forgiveness of credit would be against an overly inflated indirect cost pool because these employees are charging to an indirect charge number because you don't have work for them. If you have work for them and they're charging direct to contracts, whether they be firm fixed price, cost type, or commercial, it doesn't matter. It comes back to the issue of, and I keep driving to this because there's some exposure, there's significant exposure in terms of applying for this loan and requesting the forgiveness of this loan for payment of people, employees who are actively working in your business. Because you didn't get those funds to keep those people on the payroll, you've got plenty of work for them. And so I think you're significantly at risk as an owner of a company to certify that you use these funds to retain employees, retain workers.
Well, I disagree with that, Russ. And this is Dennis again. I think there was some question about that up until today, but this morning a new Q&A was released basically approving all self-certifications below $2 million. In other words, the government said they're going to take that at face value and they're not going to question your certification. And the way I read that and others are reading that is that it doesn't matter if you were planning to lay people off or not lay people off. You're just certifying the COVID was going to have a financial impact on your company. So I read it, I think, like someone else in this discussion does, especially based on that clarification this morning.
Yeah, this is Jerry Glover. Thanks, Dennis. And look, somebody's got their phone not muted, and there's background noise, and as many people have got on the call, please, everybody, if you're not talking, mute your phone, please.
Okay, and Dennis, if I may address the portion of the credit back to the government and how it impacts the different type of contracts. So you did say that you understand how much can be forgiven as a whole, and then once that's forgiven, if it's put into an indirect pool, kind of like an expense, and then allocated to contracts, then each contract will take on a different amount. So you're correct on that part too. Cost type contracts, like you said, of course, will have an immediate impact, right? Fixed type contracts, as everybody knows, you're being paid regardless of how much it actually cost you, right? So if this was not the PPP credit, right, if it was not the PPP credit, it would just essentially be a reduction in your expenses and then an increase in your bottom line for that fixed type contract. That would be the impact. However, there's this FAR clause, right, where they're saying that any credit that's due to the government should be credited back to the government in its appropriate amounts, right, like applicable amounts, right? Given that, and this being the PPP, I think there will be at least, additional guidance that comes out on whether on fixed-type contracts you should, credit the government for its allocable amount or not. I haven't seen any detail on, for fixed-type contracts whether that should be the case or not, but I would expect that it would be the case. So given that, the best thing we can do now to prepare for that is at least have a separate pool for the PPP, and one of the recommendations from the DOD, I think, was to name it something like COVID-19 ODC, and at least have be ready to calculate how much of the credit is allocable to every contract, regardless of contract type. I think that would at least put us in a position to react, right, based on whatever the government later decides.
Is that allocation for the overhead, is that by the year, by the month, or by the day? Because this makes a big difference of how those costs get allocated into the various programs that we've got.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, I haven't thought about that. So your question is, once the PPP forgivable amount has been determined and I choose to allocate this, is the base, right, the base of this allocation of the pool over the 8 weeks or a month or a year. Now, I don't think the government would want to create additional confusion. I don't think they would want to make this more complicated because it will then become that much more difficult for them to audit as well. If the government moves in the way that I expect them to move, I think it would be over a year. That's just my personal speculation, Bill.
I would agree that it would be over a year.
Yeah, this is Russ. I would agree as well.
Let's give somebody else another chance to ask a couple of more questions. We're 45 minutes into the call, so let's see if other folks want to ask questions, different areas and different topics.
Jerry, this is Ash here. Are we going to have, it seems like there seems to be opinion that this is a very fluid situation, which is overwhelming. And are we going to have another conference call, let's say a month from now or 2 months from now, when the rules become a little bit more solid or some directive comes out of the DCAA, which says definitively how do we handle that? And that way we are all in sync with what is supposed to be done.
A good suggestion, and we'll talk about that after this call. This was a challenge, but we'll do something. follow up on this. And yes, it clearly is fluid. And so, yes, that's a good suggestion, Ash.
This is Mike Mayo at Nanomics. Are we ready for another question?
Yes, please.
We have a question on if an employee would have potentially been laid off because the direct amount of work was reduced, say to 50% or 75%, does the employee have to do, is it an all or nothing on an employee that they would have to go complete 100% indirect during this time period that you're charging PPP, or can it be partial for individual employees? And the second question is with regard to getting the money back to the government, if the small business determines that the amount that they ask for is under these new, you know, the new information, that we would not be able to spend it the way it's designed, can we get partial amounts back to the government? Thank you.
Okay, so this is Dan again. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But when you applied for the loan, you applied for 2.5% of your monthly average payroll. And one key thing that will help us in this is to understand that, first, it is a loan, right? So that means that it's supposed to be paid back. That's the first step, right? And then in getting it is a wonderful thing, right? You got the amount, and the loan terms is that you're supposed to return it back with a very small little interest rate, and there's also a due date where you're supposed to pay it all back by, I think it's 2 years, right? The next step then is to determine the forgiveness amount. And the forgiveness amount, there's no guarantee, ever a guarantee, that you would reach the full loan amount, right? And I speculate that there will be many, many small businesses that won't be able to expend the whole amount. So whatever's left over it that couldn't be expensed and does not qualify for the forgiveness will be the remaining balance on the loan, and you would have to pay that back. Now, was there any cost in that? Not really, right, because it was 1% interest rate, and it took some of your time to apply for it. But nonetheless, the amount that's not forgiven is the portion that remains as a loan, which you will be returning back to the government by paying it back. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. So we understood that the loan would definitely be paid back. But I guess what I was really asking is that new information is coming now that has shown that, you know, we don't need as much money as we asked for. And would it be better to give it back now to help other companies utilize it, or should we wait? But let's talk about that one. But I still am interested in the per employee charges to the COVID, you know, PPP amount. Whether you can do partial hours on an employee or partial time.
Oh, I see. Okay, so. To address the first question on, you know, if I later determine that I got more than I needed, can I refund, you know, pay it back to the government? I think that's a noble thought, and it's exactly what Shake Shack did too, right? But I am not aware of any case where you could refund a portion of it back to the government, saying, okay, I just want to reduce my loan to, you know, half of what it was type of situation, right? So I'm not familiar with the anyone who has done that or how it works. So that's that part. Yeah.
Okay,
on the second part, on the second part of calculating the forgiveness amount, within the 8 weeks, you're going to have payroll, right? And there's going to be payroll regardless of whether this person was working on a contract or not, but you paid them. This entire payroll amount that you expense within the 8 weeks is the basis for calculating the forgiveness amount, right? So you would start with that. And in your case, you're talking about how there could be an individual, right, who was on leave that couldn't work, maybe because of a shutdown or because of some kind of impact of the coronavirus. Regardless, that person got PTO, pay time off, right? And it's part of payroll. And there's other people who have worked, and that's part of payroll too. The calculation method that's given now, you know, that's updated until today, is that the whole entire payroll expense is what's used to calculate the basis for first calculating the forgiveness amount, right? So I think that's how it works. Now, after the forgiveness amount is determined, I'm aware that I'm sure that everyone is aware of this, and I want to make sure that everyone is aware of this. There's the second step of calculating the reduction, right? So, you know, please be aware of that, that there is a second step reducing the forgiveness amount, and it's based on full-time equivalency, right, FTEs and salaries. So being aware of that is also important.
Just to add on to what Daniel says, if you choose not to ask for forgiveness...
Hey, guys, let's try to get a couple more questions in if we can.
Jerry, I'm wondering if we can. I'm wondering if we can go to 3:30.
There's a lot of questions. I email to check on that, and he probably knows, but he'll let us know.
We can go past an hour.
We can go past the hour. Alex, yeah.
Hello? Yes.
Yes. Good. Okay. All right. Well, let's continue on and. Let's try to keep our questions and our answers a little shorter and get more people involved in the discussion. And somebody else have another question?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Bob Akshufei from Aqua Energy. You're a startup tech company in Houston, and oil and gas is one of our most important markets. And as you know, it's been impacted by Corona massively. And so most of our commercial backlog projects have been lost. So we were wondering, we can use the PPP loan to compensate these kind of lost commercial contracts.
So there are certain expenses that are eligible to be claimed for forgiveness. 75% of the PPP loan amount has to be spent on payroll costs, which include payroll, medical insurance, 401k contribution, and unemployment taxes. And then 25% can be spent on the rent, utilities, interest on debt, and interest on debt that was in place before 2015-20. So as long as the PPP loans were spent on those types of items, those are the ones that will be eligible for forgiveness. The point of the program is to primarily be spent on salaries.
Another question.
Jerry, this is Russ. I will not be able to go beyond the time frame. I have another meeting, so I will be dropping off.
Hey, well, thanks, Russ. Appreciate you joining us.
Certainly.
Thank you, Russ.
Okay, other questions?
David Modell here again, Triton. if you have a project, it would not be considered an allowable expense, and you might or might not have continued it in the face of COVID, and you apply at least the forgiveness part of that loan toward the salaries of the individuals involved in that project. Wouldn't it cost the government anyway because it's not in the allowable cost pool? Is there any issue with that as far as you guys see that?
Well, this is Dan. I want to make sure that I understand your question correctly. You have a contract, or someone may have a contract, right?
Well, I didn't say contract. No, I didn't say contract, Mr. King. It could be a project,
okay.
Self-funded,
okay.
Or, you know, it's not a,
oh,
it's,
yeah.
It would have never gone into the allowable cost pool anyway, and it
okay.
may or may not have gone forward to get back to Russ's, you know, my interchange with Mr. Farmer. It may or may not have been canceled because of conditions, irrelevant.
Okay.
But
okay.
the PPP money, at least the forgiveness piece, the calculated
mm-hmm.
forgiveness piece, is based
mm-hmm.
on the salaries of those people involved in that project
mm-hmm.
that they wouldn't in any case be in the cost pool.
Okay. All right. Thank you for clarifying. If I may, I'd like to distinguish two things. All right. One is the calculation of the forgiveness amount, and then the other is of that forgiven amount, how much needs to be credited back to the government, right? Now, the first step in calculating the forgiveness amount, there is no language stating that the people who are on the payroll and that payroll being used to calculate the forgiveness amount have to be on certain types of projects, right? There's no language on that. There's no language stating that they have to be government contracts. I think many and most of the businesses that received the PPP loan are actually not government contractors, right?
Yep.
So, I don't think that you would have to be worried about whether the payroll that you paid for, actually paid, right, are of those individuals who are on either allowable contracts or not allowable contracts. So I don't think that is relevant in calculating the forgiveness amount, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian. Okay,
yep.
And then the second step, yeah, go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say I agree completely. They're two separate issues. So you have the PPP program, and you deal with the forgiveness piece there, and then with your left hand, you take care of the government contracting issues.
Mm-hmm.
They're two separate issues altogether.
Does that answer your question?
Well, but the intersection of those is the forgiveness one. I'll get on.
Let's go on to another question. Okay, guys, let's go on to another question. We want to cover as many questions as we can and many different people as we can. So another question from somebody. And we can carry the call along beyond the half hour, but beyond the 2 o'clock if, if people want to stay on. Any other questions?
So,
I've got a question that's probably unique, but individual proprietor that's operating under a subchapter S corporation, had to lay myself off. I applied for a PPP so that I could pay myself some salary, and I'm trying to figure out, is it available to me to increase my salary so that the proportion of salary to other costs meets the forgiveness rules?
The rules on that are vague right now, but I would assume that they will end up striking down any increases to salary. The thought process is it should encourage companies to run business as usual. So, unless your salary was at that point before the thing started, you can't all of a sudden just increase the salary because you want to hit the PPP limits. So my guess is when the final guidance comes out, they will strike that type of situation down.
Okay, but in your answer, you gave me that they wanted to keep business as usual. I thought the cause or the purpose of the loan was to keep people employed, not keep business running.
So it is to keep people employed, but
Business running. I had to shut the business down because of COVID. It's shut down. There's nothing to do.
Like I said, the rule on it is vague, and they haven't exactly come out and said it, but all the consensus out there is any kind of increases in salaries, especially for a business owner, that would be looked at.
Okay. And then may I ask some follow-on questions to you, the questioner? So when you applied for the PPP loan, and you were deciding how much you can get or determining how much you can get for the loan amount, did you use your payroll information or did you use something like that?
Used actual payroll information. But the problem or the key there is then only a portion of the PPP can be forgiven if you don't use it all for salary. And then at week, I won't be able to use all of that for salary.
Right, right. That's a very unfortunate position to be in, first of all. So, you know, yeah. It's a tough time for everyone. I hope that everyone can weather this the best that they can. Now, there's good news and bad news, of course, right? The good news is that the PPP became available, so that's good. And then when it comes to forgiveness, the calculation, the rule so far is based on salary, right? So we're aware of that. And then even if you increase your salary, right, the reduction part comes into play after you've determined the forgiveness amount. And the reduction part has to do with FTEs, like I said, and any reduction in anyone's salary, right? So if you have an individual and reduced their salary, you got to reduce the forgiveness amount about that much. But
I'm the only employee. I'm a trainer.
Yeah.
And I can't get classrooms together. So I'm
yeah. And in your case, what I foresee may happen, and I wish it's not the case, is that if you have closed your business, right? If you have closed your business, then that means there can't be salary, right? So even if you did continue to run payroll and you have a payroll report that equals to the total loan amount, right? Even if you did that in the reduction part, my speculation is that the FTE would go from 1 to 0, right? Which is 100% reduction. And the forgivable amount, I hate to say this, but possibly could be reduced to 0, right? So
okay.
I don't think increasing your salary, first of all, is like a good idea. Second thing is, if there is no business, then, you know, the fact that running payroll, I don't think would even be counted as an FTE. I'm not a lawyer, right? I'm an accountant. So that's what
right.
I think might happen.
That's right. I think you guys are probably smarter than the lawyers on this. But thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Other questions, guys. Any other questions?
Yeah. This is Dennis Wagner from Welkin Sciences again. Another. I mean, I've been thinking about how to do this credit back to the indirect rates, and you know, my thinking was this whole loan is and forgiveness is targeted toward this 8-week period, and there's very specific things that it's going to pay back. It's going to pay back 2 months of rent, 2 months of health care, plus the salaries. And so my thinking about crediting it back was, okay, I credit back 2 months of rent against my rent pool, and I credit back 2 months, and that's going to lower my indirect rates, but I may have some other higher indirect rates because of COVID-19. I've had to hire on more administrators to deal with all this stuff. So I probably will have, you know, other higher costs in the year, and I can now have 6 months to plan for that. And then, you know, those people, my admin staff that charge G&A, they're part of the salary during those 8 weeks would get credited back to the G&A pool. And if anybody was working direct on a cost contract, then those labor hours would get it credited back to the labor on the cost type contracts. So that's, I guess I have a different thought process about it than what I've heard discussed today, where you just take the whole amount of the loan and put it in some pool that gets allocated somehow. You know, how you do that allocation from just one large pool confuses me. It seems more straightforward to just credit back the specific amounts that have been forgiven during that 8-week period to the specific pools that they covered. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Okay, so my thoughts are you use so much for rent and so much for salary, right? And then the forgiveness amount is determined. Now, it does make accounting sense to segregate, you know, of that total forgiveness amount, how much would go into which pool, right? For example, if you got forgiven, let's say, you know, a couple thousand dollars for rent, for paying rent, and you know that rent goes into the GNA pool, so you would allocate that into the GNA pool. You would put $2,000 into the GNA pool as a credit, and then whoever receives a portion of that GNA would get their fair share of that $2,000, right? And
correct.
Then the other portion you're talking about is I have some folks that are indirect, right? And they normally charge the overhead pool. And I paid for theirs. I got, you know, a forgiveness for that amount. I'd like to put that into the overhead pool and then allocate it, right? And then
right.
You're talking about there are some folks that are direct. I've, you know, got forgiveness for that. I would make that a direct credit back to those contracts that they worked on.
The labor.
Yeah. Accounting-wise, that is... It's a good idea, right? Accounting wise, right? And
right.
The more you can make an expense a direct cost, it's better than making it an indirect cost. So that's that. But in practical terms, I think that would overcomplicate the whole crediting back to government calculation, right? And then it would also create more work to justify on your end to prove, right? Okay, this amount was paid for this, and I put it in here. Type of thing. You have to show all the details, and then more work for the auditors too. So what I personally find to be more practical is to put it into one pool first and then allocate it according to how much labor every contract consumes, and then also according to how much labor there is in the overhead pool and the GNA pool. And if you do that, essentially you're allocating it just like fringe, right? So the credit gets allocated to everything, just like fringe. And then the government's amounts that they need to be credited back can be calculated as such. And when you have to justify that, it's rather simple. It's also rather simple for the auditor to agree. So that's just my opinion.
Okay.
I agree with Daniel on it. It seems like the simplest way to handle the credit piece.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have time.
This
for...
is Bob Schmidt. I don't think that anybody's looking for the simplest way. I think they're looking for the most profitable way. So is it wrong to be able to allocate it to the different pools that it paid for those particular individuals or the rent, et cetera?
Quite honestly, we're waiting on the there should be guidance coming out of DCA at some point that will tell us which way is going to be acceptable. So we're going to be subject to those guidelines when they eventually come out.
Okay, and I appreciate that comment too, you know, because as a business owner, you have to think about both things, right? Practicality and also profit and cost effectiveness. Yeah.
Yep.
And in this situation, what I can imagine, if you stretch, right, go on a stretch and make determine that you're going to make the most profit, is to direct charge all of the forgiveness amounts to a non-government contract, right? Then everything would be yours, and you wouldn't have to provide the government any credit for it. But then by doing that, you're essentially going against the rule that in the FAR that says the government shall be credited, right, for its share of any credit. And that's essentially where I think you'd run into trouble if anybody, not that anybody should or would do that, but, you know, try to profit off of this credit.
This is Bob Schmidt again. I've got another series of questions on utilities. I think we all agree that water, sewer, and electric are utilities. Is the Internet a utility?
So the SBA's define utilities as phone, internet, gas, water, electricity, and et cetera. We expect in the next week that they should have better guidance on what et cetera means. So.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's thank everybody, especially our panelists. We certainly appreciate your sharing your knowledge, extensive expertise with us. I will close the call with one comment from my tax professor in law school, and I don't remember anything else the man said, but he said, remember, get fat and hogs get slaughtered. Don't get too greedy on anything.
Excellent.
I have always remembered that, and I find it particularly true in things like this where they're sort of soft and fuzzy. So just, you know, pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. So
Jerry, that's one of our favorite phrases in the office. We love that one.
Excellent.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. We certainly appreciate your involvement and your participation. We will have this on for, you know, to have other people in your offices call in to set that up in a few days and let everybody know it's there. But, again, Dan and Brian, you guys are phenomenal experts, thank you for participating, and we look forward to further discussions. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Stay healthy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.